These days, Peter Singer teaches bioethics at Princeton University. He's the author of the classic 1975 work Animal Liberation and many other books on practical ethics and rethinking life and death, the ethics of what we eat. He's also at the University of Melbourne, attached to the Centre for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics. This latest book, though, is devoted to the work of another writer. Peter Singer has co-edited with Anton Leist a collection of essays by philosophers on the work of the writer J.M. Coetzee, more specifically on what the work has to say about ethical problems of sex, race, animals, even the role of reason. It's called J.M. Coetzee and Ethics, Philosophical Perspectives on Literature. And Peter Singer, it's good to be speaking with you again.
It's good to be with you again, Ramona, yes.
Well, you point out in the introduction that philosophy has tended to hold itself at a distance from literature, and it's all Plato's fault, of course. Remind us what that was all about, that clash.
Well, I don't know that we're all Platonists about this, but Plato thought that when he described the Republic, the ideal society, that there really shouldn't be a place for fiction. He thought fiction is basically just untruths, lies, right? And why should you have that in the Republic, people who tell things that are not true? You should focus on what's true. That's a very crude rendering of it. But I wouldn't say that, you know, that's really kept philosophy and literature apart throughout the 2.5 millennia that have followed, but perhaps it had an influence for a time. But certainly, generally, though, philosophers have thought literature doesn't have much to say to us. You know, we're concerned with a rigorous analysis of the search for truth, and literature is all very nice, it's entertaining, you can enjoy it, but it's a completely separate activity.
So there has been, though, a tradition of literature and ethics, or storytelling and ethics. For example, the role of animals in fables.
Yes, certainly. I mean, if you look at ethics in the more popular sense, literature, storytelling is incredibly important, I think. But philosophers have sort of thought, well, that's more, you know, the kind of that's not the sort of ethics we do. We talk about things like the categorical imperative and more abstract principles. We don't tell little homilies to get our children to be kind to animals. We're onto something rather
different.
Even
the moral philosophers.
Yes, although I
don't they
guess
set up situations? A man and a son, and somebody else who's a neighbour, and what we owe the son and what we owe the neighbour, and you do that yourself.
I do that, yes, and I suppose you could say that since the 1970s, roughly, philosophers have been more interested in applied ethics, and that has involved telling stories, often hypothetical examples of various kinds to test something. You know, there's a runaway train and you're standing by the switch and it can go down one track where it'll kill five people or another where it'll kill one. What do you do? So, yeah, we do use little stories to get people to think about these issues. And perhaps that's brought philosophy and literature closer together. I've sometimes thought of publishing a completely different anthology from this one where you collect the sort of science fiction type examples that philosophers write about and display them and talk about them. I think that would be fun, but that's not literature, obviously.
Maybe it is. Why isn't it literature?
Well, philosophers invent them for a very specific purpose, then generally rather bare bones, abstract sort of stuff. They don't have the depth. They don't have the character.
But it is storytelling. It does engage us.
It's a kind of story. I suppose it does depend how you're going to define literature. I mean, I wouldn't put it on the same level as Coetzee's novels.
But what is it about the work of J.M. Coetzee then that has attracted all these philosophers in this collection to analyse it for meaning?
Well, because I think he really does, in his novels, explore moral issues and moral questions quite deeply. He also raises important moral issues fairly directly. For me, part of the interest, of course, is that he raises this question about how we treat animals very directly, and that's where I first came across him, when he was giving the lectures at Princeton, The Lives of Animals, which became two of the chapters of Elizabeth Costello.
Were you surprised? Were you there in the audience when he was giving those?
I was a commentator on it. Right. The Tanner lectures have four commentators.
Because he's invited to give a lecture and he reads a piece of fiction.
That's right, exactly. So I knew in advance because I'd been given the text, and I suppose one of the reasons I was invited to be a commentator was because the text was obviously about something that I'd written about at length. So in that sense, I wasn't surprised, but I think everybody else there was very surprised that, you know, at what he was doing, that he wasn't really giving a lecture, but as you say, he was reading a piece of fiction, and also that the content of it was pretty confronting, I think, to an audience who no doubt had come along because they admired him as a novelist, and here they were actually, you could say, getting harangued in a way in the sense of the content of the lecture that Elizabeth Costello, the fictional character, is giving. But that's what J.M. Coetzee is reading to them.
But he would have given that as his lecture if
yes.
he was minded to give that sort of lecture.
Well, that's of course an open question, and that's one of the questions that puzzled me as a commentator. How should I take this? Should I take this as an expression of the views of J.M. Coetzee? But this is fiction, and he's not Elizabeth Costello, even though there are parallels. I mean, parallels both in the name and parallels in the fact that Elizabeth Costello came from Australia, in other words, from a southern hemisphere former British colony, as Coetzee then was coming from South Africa at the time. So there were clearly parallels, but I wasn't sure whether I could take it as an expression of his views, and I guess since he hasn't really spoken very explicitly about that, it's hard to say how much it is. That's one of the things that I explore in my contribution to the volume, to Coetzee at Ethics.
So you say that the audience was, they were being harangued about animal, about the lives of animals.
Well, I mean, Elizabeth Costello does have very strong views, and she basically talks about the mass slaughter of animals as a horrible thing. She has an explicit comparison to the Holocaust. She says it's like when somebody wears leather, it's like somebody saying to you, here we have some beautiful skin from a Polish Jewess. So, you know, that's pretty confronting. If you go into that lecture and you're wearing leather and here's somebody telling you this, or at least in the guise of the fictional character telling you this, I think it is confronting.
So that's how you came to the work of J.M. Coetzee. But then some of the other people in this book also point out that John Coetzee has made them think about all kinds of things. I mean, that description of Elizabeth Costello and John Coetzee and who's giving the lecture, and we're in a lecture room and we're having a reading about a fictional person who's in a lecture room. I mean, this all is sort of a reality and truth and things reflecting each other, and what's real and what's not, and who are we, and how what is our consciousness, and how do we know that? How do I know that's really you, Peter Singh, across the table, or maybe not, or a fictional contrast of you trying to project yourself as Peter Singh? This is the sort of thing that the philosophers deal with, isn't it?
Yes, we do deal with those questions, and you're right that some of those questions are raised by the structures of his works and the way in which he invents these fictional characters, and perhaps it's most explicit in the more recent Diary of a Bad Year, where you have that strange structure where on each page you have part of, at the top, an essay that is being written by this character, J.C., which are like essays in political philosophy and to some extent in ethics. Then you have J.C.'s diary of what's happening, which is much more about his relationship with this attractive young woman he spies. And then you have some notes from the woman herself, who becomes a kind of typist for him. So the parallels there, you know, he's saying, so is Coetzee, since he has the same initials, and in fact the character in the novel actually is the author of a book, Waiting for the Barbarians, which Coetzee has written. Are these political philosophy essays really his views and the other stuff is fiction or what? You know, he does play with the reader in that way, and it's interesting.
Have you ever spoken to him and discussed these things with him?
I have spoken to him on the occasion of the Tanner lectures are held over 3 days, two lectures and a seminar. And during that time, the people involved have lunches and dinners together all the time. So I saw quite a lot of him then. And then more recently, I saw him just over a year ago in Adelaide when my book, The Life You Can Save, came out. There was an event held in Adelaide, which he chaired and introduced me, and then we had dinner afterwards. So we have had some conversations. At Princeton, he was very reserved in terms of talking about what he was doing, what his views were. I mean, he is a vegetarian. It sort of was obvious that he did support the views of Elizabeth Costello to that extent. But he didn't really open up about, you know, to what extent this was his views and to what extent it wasn't. He's since, I think, become more open about it, and that's one of the things that Karen Dorn and I explore in our essay in the book. So he supported organisations in Australia like Voiceless and the Australian Association for Humane Research. And he was, I think, therefore, you know, more open when we talked in Adelaide a year or so ago. But he doesn't like to talk, you know, he likes to let the books speak for themselves, I guess you could put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to have him talking to me about all kinds of things, but he's not very fond of being interviewed.
I imagine. No, yeah,
but it was
yeah,
very interesting. Yeah. One of the references that I looked at in this book, I saw there was an email conversation between J.M. Coetzee and someone called Arabella Kurtz, which is in one of the references, one of the essays. And she turns out to be a consultant clinical psychologist working on a doctoral clinical psychology training program at the University of Leicester, and she sort of engaged him in this conversation, which was interesting. But he didn't really want to have a conversation. He wanted to have an email conversation, and he says, "Let me make three observations about myself. I was an academic most of my working life, and when I talk about literature, I tend to talk like an academic. Two, when I have written a book, I put it behind me, and I don't like to revisit it.
Right.
And three, I never interpret my own books. I leave that to readers and critics." But he interesting, and further on, he says, "If I could do just a little to help psychology from its aspiration to be a science, or failing that, if I could help mark out a disciplinary area where operations of the mind could be explored by means other than what we call the scientific method, I would be happy." Which sort of leads me to talk a little bit about this idea of his views about Western culture and rationality, which is something that you philosophers yes. like to think about.
Yes, that's right. I'm very interested in what he has to say about that. And as we were saying a moment ago, I'm very attracted to his writing because of some of the substantive views that he puts forward. His views about animals, for example, I agree with. But there is always this critique of what I actually do, that is, of reasoning about it. Even in The Lives of Animals, in Elizabeth Costello, in putting forward these views, she has disparaging remarks about philosophers who produce arguments about this. She somehow seems to think that it's just obvious, or you should just know that the mass slaughter of animals is wrong. You don't have to develop philosophical arguments. So there is a critique of rational argument and that kind of discourse running through his books. And
which is weird, because on many levels, there people, I mean, I've often thought that these are very interesting books, but they're cold, and the, you know, the level of emotion in them is lukewarm, and if somebody has to sort of suddenly sort of be emotionally connected maybe to the idea of the killing of animals and just know in their guts that you know it's wrong, I'm surprised that might come from the writings that are cool.
I see. I don't really see them as cool. I see the language as restrained, but I think in restrained language he really presents emotions that are pretty deep and that I feel quite strongly. I can sort of sense Elizabeth Costello's rage at the way we treat animals. I can also feel, I guess, in Disgrace, I think you can sort of feel David Lurie's sense of attitude to the world, his anger, his hostility to certain things in it. I think there are emotions that are presented quite deeply, really.
I don't find them presented in a hot way.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. But I suppose I like that because I felt, I mean, in writing Animal Liberation, I was describing things that to me were just, you know, really shocking, really disturbing. I would spend days in libraries reading descriptions by the experimenters themselves of what they were doing to animals in experiments. And I would be in a rage about it, but I knew that if I wrote that in a really hot way, it would just turn people off. It would be a polemic. So I had to try and be cool. And I sometimes think that Coetzee is doing the same there.
Yeah, I mean, the question, I suppose, does James Coetzee want us to do more than immerse ourselves in his characters and stories? Does he want to teach us how to think about them? But then again, if he's got a critique of rationality,
yes.
He doesn't want us to think about them, does he?
Look.
Where is he? Why can't he tell us
himself?
That's
a very good question. My sense is that he does want us to think about them, but he doesn't want us to go through simply arguments, that it's a different kind of thinking. Some of the Alice Crary in her essay in the book, for example, talks about this in a way. It's a broader conception of reason and thought that includes emotional thinking in some way that he's talking about.
We mentioned disgrace, this is, you know, a film was made about it. It's set in post-apartheid South Africa. It gives us a very disturbing picture of post-apartheid South Africa. What is he saying about race relations and building a new South Africa from a philosophical point of view?
Yeah. I mean, I think he's very aware of the burden of the past, of all those years of apartheid. And he's, you know, one of the things that's clear with him, and it's very clear in Disgrace, is he's aware of what human beings are like, and he doesn't always think you can change it. So, for example, Disgrace starts off with the disgrace in it is that David Lurie is, you know, getting dismissed from the university or censored for his sexual relationship with a student. But he says, well, you know, you can't stop desire. You have to accept desire, and I'm not ashamed of desire. The character David Lurie says that.
So is part of his sort of view of himself as an animal.
That's right, exactly, yes. We are animals, and so we are just going to have, you know, desires, and also people are going to want some sort of vengeance or, you know, some sort of way of getting back at those who've done things to them. So I think he sees the Africans who then attack the farm at the end and rape David Lurie's daughter Lucy and even shoot the dogs in their cages, the watchdogs. He sees that as in some sense understandable. I mean, he hates it, but he can see it in some way as a price you pay for what happened in the past. So he's not painting a rosy picture of South Africa, but he's also not saying at all, you know, see, these Africans can't run the country, they needed the whites. It's totally the reverse of that. But he is saying you can't expect it to be an easy, peaceful, smooth transition, given what's happened in the past.
And the sexual politics in that book too have been noted.
Yes. I mean, you know, Coetzee never wants to be politically correct, or at least he just has a mind that isn't politically correct, and he's not going to perform the sort of way that people want. And he's been, you know, people maybe think, well, a great South African writer should be standing up for the things that are right in this way, you know, for the core sort of lefty liberal causes that probably most of his readers support. But he isn't prepared to do it because, as you were saying, he thinks that we are animals in some way, and this idea of expecting males not to have sexual desires for their students is kind of fanciful. It's not the way the world is, and we should acknowledge it. That doesn't mean that we have to turn a blind eye to these things or accept them, but the way in which we try to deal with them, he seems to think, is just superficial.
So are you going to now, I mean, it sounds to me like you've embraced the idea of philosophers and literary writers being able to talk to each other after all these, 2,500 years or whatever. Are you going to look at other writers and the work of
No,
other
I
writers?
Don't have plans to do more of this type. I mean, I was particularly interested in Coetzee. I think he is a fascinating writer. I also had my co-editor Anton Leist, who was interested in it and proposed the idea, which I was happy to accept because of my particular interest in Coetzee. But I have other writing plans. And
what are your other writing plans?
Well, I'm wanting, after many years of doing work in applied ethics, I am wanting to do something more about the nature of ethics. And to some extent it does, you know, it follows from this book, but in a different way, because I'm interested in exploring the role of reason in ethics and how far we really can get with reason and what are the possibilities there. So Coetzee's critique of that is something that's relevant to the future work, but it will be in a more philosophical mode.
Well, Peter Singer, thanks for being our guest on The Book Show today.
It was a pleasure, Ramona.
And the book that Peter Singer has co-edited with Anton Leist is called J.M. Coetzee and Ethics, Philosophical Perspectives on Literature, and it's published by Columbia University Press, but available in Australia from Footprint Books. You're on The Book Show with me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National.